Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Merry Christmas and welcome back to Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione. We had a very, very busy week to 10 days at the New Civil Liberties Alliance ahead of the Christmas holiday. And so we have lots and lots to talk about in this episode, even though things will hopefully be a little bit quieter during the Christmas holidays themselves. But in any event, one of the things that happened this past week is that we filed an amicus brief in the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called, and this was on the merits, in a case called Federal Elections Commission v. Ted Cruz for Senate. Ted Cruz being the senator from Texas and former Republican presidential candidate. And there are a couple of different issues in this case, including a First Amendment issue, but it all boils down to the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, BCRA, which, Beck, you'll remember that BCRA was already up to the Supreme Court at least once in the was it FEC v. McConnell or McConnell v. FEC, a very sort of famous debate. Yep. Between Senator McConnell and Senator McCain on some of the constitutionality of BCRA. But this the particular provision at issue here has to do with Section 304 of BCRA, which states that campaigns may repay no more than $250,000 of pre-election loans with post-election contributions. And the idea behind this section of BCRA, it was the anti-millionaires provision of BCRA. There seemed to be a spate of multimillionaires running for the U.S. Senate, that these folks were largely self-funding their campaigns and then would refund themselves, particularly if these folks won. I suppose they would have some money come in from the usual lobbyist sources and PAC sources, and I suppose that the idea here was to prevent the sort of well-heeled from taking advantage of that, and to put some limits on the ability to pay yourself back for any loans that you have given to your campaign. So, no surprise, Vec, the incumbents in Congress came up with an incumbent protection plan to make it harder for millionaires to run against them and unseat them from their office. So, it travels as a good government provision, but in truth, it's an incumbent protection plan. How often have we seen that story play out in Washington, D.C.? But there's something else interesting going on in this case, because in his 2018 campaign for re-election to the U.S. Senate from Texas, Ted Cruz loaned his campaign committee $260,000, $10,000 more than Section 304 would permit him to be repaid using post-election contributions. And you might think, oh, what a mistake. Someone should have caught that. Well, I don't think it was a mistake. I think this was a deliberate decision on the part of the Cruz campaign to test the constitutionality of this aspect of the statute. And of course, these sort of test plaintiffs, this happens all the time, right? I mean, that's how laws like this get tested, is that you violate them in certain kinds of strategic ways, and that gives you then standing to challenge the rule in federal court. Well, the Federal Election Commission didn't like this idea very much at all, didn't want to be challenged on this statutory provision, and so they came up with a new heightened standard for standing. And as I say, standing is the idea that only those folks who are harmed by a provision can challenge it. You know, if there's lots of laws out there John and I don't like, but we can't just go suing over them unless we have a client who's being harmed by those laws. And even, and Vec knows this all too well, even when we find someone who's been harmed, and even when we can show that they've been harmed, and even when we can show that the government is at fault or a particular law is at fault for that harm, a lot of times the government is able to wriggle out of responsibility anyway by changing its mind at the last minute. So it's sort of maddening to be in these fights against the government sometimes. But in this case, the Federal Election Commission stuck by its guns, and it just said that Senator Cruz and the campaign didn't have standing to challenge the law, because what they said is, well, you're challenging the statute, but your harm comes from the regulation. And you can't challenge the statute when your harm comes from the regulation, because one of the aspects of standing is that your injury has to be, quote, fairly traceable, unquote, to the complained of conduct. And according to the FEC, the complained of conduct here is the regulation in question, not the statute. Well, that might seem like a sort of esoteric point, but stop and consider the significance of that. If FEC's theory of standing were adopted, that would significantly restrict judicial challenges to all kinds of unlawful federal government actions. And that's why NCLA got involved in this case. We don't necessarily care about election law per se. We're not particularly, interested in the outcome of this particular dispute. But this standing issue has significance well outside of the FEC context, well outside of the Cruz campaign's liability for or ability to self-fund or repay itself for self-funding above the $250,000 threshold. As I say, there may be First Amendment issues there as well, but that's not a part of the case that NCLA weighed into. We were very concerned about this standing issue. And FEC argues that if the loss here, the $10,000 loss, right, because he loaned the campaign $260,000, and FEC is saying, oh, there's a cap at $250,000. So this $10,000 loss is only fairly traceable to the FEC regulation and not to the enabling statute. But the regulation itself, the sole authority for issuing that regulation is Section 304 of BCRA. So to say that it's not fairly traceable, if this isn't fairly traceable, if this harm isn't fairly traceable to the statute, then it's going to be very difficult to say that other similar kinds of regulatory harms are fairly traceable to the statute. The other thing that's interesting about the FEC's position is they say that because the Cruz campaign deliberately triggered the law, that is, they deliberately loaned more than the $250,000 limit in order to be able to test the law. And for that reason, Vec, that the Cruz campaign doesn't have standing to sue. And I had to laugh when I read that, because I think Rosa Parks would be very surprised to find out that if you deliberately violate a law that you don't have standing to challenge it.
It's insane. There almost every major landmark decision that, for instance, the ACLU's brought, I mean, they were set up. They were often set up on purpose. I mean, that the whole point was you got to challenge. First, you got to find someone willing to actually go against the law in order to get standing, which takes a lot of guts. And then to say, oh, that doesn't do it? Come on.
Yeah, there's a reason Brown v. Board of Education is the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. I mean, they deliberately picked a plaintiff that they thought was a good plaintiff for that purpose. And there were other plaintiffs as well. It was a group of plaintiffs, group of consolidated cases there by the time it got to the Supreme Court. But the efforts here to pick a plaintiff or to test a statute, that's not something that began in 2018 with Senator Cruz. I mean, this goes back to the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, a lot of First Amendment religious cases. I mean, these things are often, these test cases are often deliberately done. Now, not always. I don't think that the Westboro Baptist Church, if I can stick with with an unfortunate Kansas example, that they were out there doing this in order to test the First Amendment. I think that they're just jerks and were out there doing what they do for reasons other than hoping to set a First Amendment precedent, but they did so nonetheless. But here, I think that the Cruz campaign, I think it's fair to say that the reason that they attributed $260,000 instead of $250,000 is, I'm going to bet that Senator Cruz, not a big fan of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002. And I don't think that he's necessarily the kind of multimillionaire. I'm sure he did well in private practice at his law firm before he ran for office. But I don't think he's the kind of inherited wealth multimillionaire person that the folks who drafted BCRA were trying to hamper in their election campaigns. Nonetheless, Senator Cruz is a former top appellate lawyer and a known constitutional law expert. And he probably, as he became aware, this is my guess, I haven't talked to him, I don't know how this panned out, but my guess is he became aware of this provision in the course of his campaign. And he said, well, that's ridiculous. Let's do something to test that. And so he did. And now the case is up to the Supreme Court. So, you know, our concern again here at NCLA is not just that the FEC's position is wrong or that standing needs to be found in this particular case, but if the Supreme Court were to buy into the FEC's theory of standing here, then that would dramatically impair the ability of critics of government overreach to bring challenges to other unconstitutional federal statutes. And that's not something that we want to see happen. We want to be able to continue to hold the government to account and put constitutional constraints on the administrative state. We'll be right back with more. Welcome back to Administrative Static here on Christmas Day, and we've had a little bit of red on Christmas Day with some of the discussion of the Wuhan virus out of China, John. So maybe it's time for a discussion of a little green on Christmas Day, and that's another case that the New Civil Liberties Alliance was involved in this past week against the Environmental Protection Agency, and the case is styled West Virginia v. EPA, and it has to do with the efforts to interpret the Clean Air Act to give the EPA vast power over really the energy generating plants around the country. And that this whole controversy goes back to the Obama administration, where the Obama administration, well, I guess if you go back far enough, in 2009, again, during the Obama administration, Congress was talking about, and this was a Congress, you may recall, that was controlled, both the House and the Senate was controlled by the same party as the president, the Democrat Party of President Obama. And Congress looked at the issue of carbon dioxide emissions, and the House narrowly passed legislation that was intended to address global warming, and this was one of the President Obama's sort of promised transformations of America was to transform the way that the nation produces and uses energy. And he promised that your energy bill will skyrocket. I don't know if you remember that. I don't think that was one of his more popular pledges, but he did promise that. However, the Senate chose not to go along with the House's bill. They didn't pass a bill. And so there wasn't anything coming out of Congress to change the Clean Air Act or to provide the EPA with any more statutory authority than it already had under the original Clean Air Act. Well, nonetheless, the creative folks over at EPA decided to claim the power to do what they wanted to do anyway. And so they claimed what I would say is at best questionable authority under Section 7411 to ignore Congress and, you know, bicameralism be damned. There was a bill out of the House and the president supported it. So why do we need that pesky Senate that the Constitution talks about? We had two out of three. Shouldn't that be good enough to push forward with our plans for progress? That seemed to be the attitude the EPA took when they formulated the Clean Power Plan. And that determined that the best system to reduce carbon emissions was what's called generation shifting. So not in the sense of one generation to the next, but rather in the sense of what sort of products are you using to generate electricity. So if you can effectively replace all of the fossil fuel-based electricity with electricity generated from zero-emitting renewable energy sources, then you can reduce the carbon emissions. And I have to laugh at some of the people I know around here who drive electric cars. Vec, I don't know what the situation is in Colorado, but there had historically been a fair amount of coal in the mix for electricity generation in Virginia. So a lot of these folks that were at least, you know, 10 years ago, a lot of these folks who were driving around electric cars and were so proud of themselves were driving what I like to consider coal-powered automobiles because they might be pulling electricity from the grid, but that electricity was coming from coal. And the idea that they were somehow virtue signaling by their driving of electric cars was pretty amusing to me. But anyway, getting back to the matter at hand, West Virginia v. EPA, that case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court in February of 2016, and it was one of the very last things that Justice Scalia heard and dealt with before his untimely passing. And the Supreme Court stayed the implementation of the CPP, the Clean Power Plan. And I think what was going on there is that the court recognized that if it didn't put a stay on the plan, that by the time the energy companies were able to get to go through all the normal process and get everything up in front of the Supreme Court for a decision, that the Clean Power Plant would have largely been implemented and any decision would have been rather academic. And so it had to stay it in order to prevent being overtaken by events and allowing the plaintiffs in that case to have a legitimate shot at not being forced to comply with something that didn't have any statutory authority for it. Well, surprisingly then, later in 2016, or at least surprisingly to a lot of people, there was a change of administration. Well, I guess the change of administration that took place wasn't surprising, but the fact that it wasn't Hillary Clinton taking over from Barack Obama was the surprising part to many folks. And the new administration did not think that the Clean Power Plan was a good idea, and it replaced it with something called the Affordable Clean Air Energy Rule. And then that was vacated by the D.C. Circuit on January 19th of 2021, the second to last day of the Trump administration. And it concluded that the promulgation of that rule and the embedded repeal of the Clean Power Plan rested critically on a mistaken reading of the Clean Air Act. And the EPA, the D.C. Circuit said, had acted within its powers to issue the Clean Power Plan. So that is the issue that's now up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And the concern that NCLA has is largely this dodging of bicameralism. And ordinarily, Vec, if and we saw this with the Gundy case, with SORNA, Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, that there had been one version of it that had gone through the House and a different version of it had gone through the Senate. And ultimately, both houses passed the same version, but there's one of the bodies had really dealt with and made it clear whether they wanted the statute to be retroactive or not. The other one didn't. and the final language that passed kicked the question to the Attorney General to decide. And so our concern there had been, wait a minute, Congress needs to be the one to make these calls. They can't just kick the decision to the Attorney General. But the Supreme Court allowed SORNA, allowed Congress and the Department of Justice to get away with that. And we see something similar going on here, where the House passed a piece of legislation to deal with emissions, but the Senate never did, Vec. And I would think that that under general principles, we would think that there's likely not a delegation of legislative power taking place at all when only one of the two houses has acted.
Well, it's happened so much where presidents come in, and it's happened a lot under every administration. They come in and they try to get something passed, and it doesn't get passed. And they go, ta-da, we have that power anyway through this agency. Well, then why are we doing this?
Pen and a phone, right?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, no, I think that's what's happening here. And the concern that NCLA has expressed in our amicus brief filed this week is that we don't want the Supreme Court to look at this and decide that this is something that can be delegated to the EPA. Even under existing doctrine, there has to be an intelligible principle that would come from the statute from Congress to the agency telling them what to do in this situation. And here the law wasn't passed. The new authority wasn't passed. So you have to go all the way back to the Clean Air Act in the early 90s and try to really hard to read something into that to find this power. And that's not how to do good government. It's certainly not how to do representative government. And we're going to lose our self-government if we keep allowing agencies to go back into old laws and find new powers and that Congress didn't give to them. So what we've told the Supreme Court is, look, this so-called non-delegation doctrine is misleading and it's fictitious because the doctrine disguises what it does. It implies that a delegation is something that can be easily revocable, but it's not. Once you acknowledge, if the Supreme Court were to acknowledge that the EPA has this power, there's no way that the next Congress or the next president could take that back without passing a statute and that statute would have to go through both houses of Congress and would have to be signed by the president. So if you allow these sort of sloppy extensions of power on the front end, it's very difficult to get them back on the back end. And so they're not really delegations, they're divestments of legislative power from the accountable to the people legislative branch to the unaccountable to the people Environmental Protection Agency in this case. And we don't want to see that happen. Furthermore, the Constitution doesn't allow Congress to divest itself of legislative power. That's partly for separation of powers reasons that we've talked about before. But the text of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, says that legislative power shall be vested in Congress, not elsewhere, not in the executive branch. It's vested in Congress. In fact, it says all legislative power shall be vested. So not only is it the all, but it's the shall be vested that tells you that that's where legislative power resides, not in the executive branch, certainly not in the agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency. And so we've told the Supreme Court, look, the executive can't exercise legislative power. It can't evade the requirements of bicameralism and presentment that happen here. And wherever else, and let me just dwell on that for a minute, wherever else you draw the line, wherever else you might want to say that some amount of legislative power might leak at the margins out to the executive branch, it's certainly, and which I don't subscribe to, but I, there are some on the Supreme Court who don't seem to be as abstemious about this as NCLA. At least you have to draw the line to say that if something passes one house of Congress and doesn't pass the other house of Congress, it has failed bicameralism, and you cannot allow legislation that hasn't gotten the approval of both houses of Congress to become law. But that's effectively what would be happening with the Clean Air Act and the Clean Power Plan if the Supreme Court lets this go through. they put a stay on it once before, and after someone hopefully the court will do so permanently when presented with this issue early